Failsafe, guidance for resilient cloud architectures, developed by Microsoft Services and the Azure Customer Advisory Team.
Why do we do functional decomposition? At the end of the day, it's really about reducing complexities. What do cells do when they become too complicated? They multiply. They kind of split and become simpler cells again and so forth. So the organism is already kind of in place to do that kind of thing. Really, we're trying to figure what the system does before we're thinking through the how. And there's lots of aspects of how we do things. And then draw boundaries and identify dependencies. So Mark talked a lot about dependencies in the services sense. There's also dependencies intra-service. So you have dependencies on other workloads, and you have understanding saying, I have two roles in my Azure sense that run the Twitter site, and there are five roles that run the live stats site and so forth. And they have dependencies with each other. So you also need to understand how to do that. You can model them as services. That's a fine way of doing things. If you don't want to do that because you want them deployed and managed in a similar fashion, you might want to think about role groups and so forth, and we talk about some of those concepts. There are common decomposition methods. The first one I will talk to you about is based upon a method that I was part of the invention group around, which is called business capability driven. As it turns out, a lot of businesses do the things they do since quite some time. Lots of people add capability and remove capability, but what's really changing is actually how they execute on those capabilities. And we will walk you through what that means and how you think about this. There's a couple of things around manageability. When you have a very innovative site, you have a lot of stuff that's very volatile. So you don't want to mix very stable things that don't change a lot with things that do change a lot. So you want to be able to look at a number of capabilities there. I'm not sure we talk about multi-tenancy here. Multi-tenancy tends to be also a very, very naughty thing when you have to think about availability. Because once you have multiple tenants, you have to think about how you make, what's availability? Is that across all tenants? Is the 5-user email site the same as a 100,000 user email site? So that's, for example, one of the complexities the Exchange and SharePoint and some other groups inside Microsoft are grappling with. How do you provide that? Just as a side note, if you guys can avoid multi-tenancy in your software project, go for it. Don't introduce multi-tenancy if you don't have to. And so forth. So a lot of times scale and performance, we talked about that, really influence the decomposition. From my perspective, there's always a business view on composition, and then there is a technical view on the composition. They're not the same often, but they lead, you can align them with each other. And then compliance, security, and risk. Some data is more sensitive than others. Some activities might be inconsequential, so you're okay, so you need to understand those. So these are dimensions of decomposition that you want to go through. Yep?
What about where the data is?
So the observation is, or the question is, what about where the data is? The way I look at workloads in general, workloads have their own data. They are partitioned, and they look at themselves as owning their own data. Because when you introduce shared data models with multiple workloads against that, like in common ERP system today, you're introducing dependencies that effectively say, yes, you have done a functional decomposition, but you have not done an operational decomposition. Because you now the database is still the point of failure for all of these workloads. And while that's okay, you can do that, and we have done that very successfully in the world of cloud, you don't see that that often. Mark kind of casually talked about people actually now going to the extreme to say, for my workload, it makes sense to use a column store. For my other workload, it makes sense to go relational. And for my third workload, I'm going to do something table stores. So they actually are not only looking at data partitioning, they're actually also aligning the different store technologies or retrieval technologies with their workloads. Again, that's a very extreme view. You don't have to do that, but it's certainly something you want to be able to do if that is what it takes. Again, I will do a lot of commentary throughout the decomposition models because I have a certain view on these things. It's really interesting when you look at what cloud computing does today. I remember speeches I gave to internal and external audiences about what I call a data model aligned with a workload that's ER complete. So entity relationship models that are focused on the workload. So you effectively cluster capabilities and you say, okay, this is the data that this workload needs. It can actually take dependencies on other data, what we call master data, reference data, to say, I don't manage customers. I'm an order system. I need customers in order to fulfill the orders, but I don't manage them. So I want to get customer data from the customer management service, and I will ask for that. And there is an SLA in place around the data, not just about the availability of the customer management service, but how long is the data valid? Do I have to go back every time and do a real-time query, or can I cache the query, the data, and stuff like that? So we'll talk about some of these things. Some of you have might seen this. This is a methodology that Microsoft Services still uses in the enterprise strategy business, where we help customers look at business capabilities. And the business capability modeling method came about as part of our acquisition, or we're starting to go into the business application division. So remember, 2000, we announced the acquisition of Great Plains. Before that, we didn't build any business application stuff. And so I was part of the team around David Vaskovich that did the due diligence, the strategy, and why and what and so forth. And as part of that, we hired a group of domain experts to say, if we were to focus on manufacturing and light distribution, or light manufacturing and distribution, that was the way, in North America, what capabilities would a business expect, a small and medium business? We had no idea, so we kind of said, let's come up with this notion, and they called it the process model. A process model they really didn't define because there were no time dimensions on it and other things that I associate with process, but they did define this capability model. And they did a very nice decomposition down to level 5 in their capability or process model, where they talked about designing, develop products and services, then have new services, and so forth. And that process model guided us with respect to evaluation of the product or companies that were out in the market and say, would we buy this one or that one, or would we build it ourselves? And we ended up merging or acquiring Great Plains and then later Navision as the companies that implement these kind of capabilities. But it was a great tool to use as part of the conversation with the customer. What is it that we want to build or buy? And kind of as a North Star. I had a printout of all these capabilities in a Visio diagram that was about 50 megabytes at the time, pretty much only data. And it was 1,000 different capabilities. You had to print it out on 4 feet by some other feet. It was really big. So I had a roll with me when we talked about SOA. And I talked to the customers about SOA, and we showed effectively not just this piece, but the real drawing had effectively connections between these capabilities, not on this level, a little bit lower, to show how does collaboration work with generate demand? What are the documents that flow? What are the interfaces? And I used blackouts to talk. Now you see all these details. Now I'm going to hide this and effectively say the development product and services is all of a sudden a service in a logical sense. And all of the interfaces that are sticking out are the it's the only thing that you really know about that service. You don't know anything anymore how the service internally works. And so people got it, but after 20 minutes they all stopped me and said, yeah, this web service stuff is interesting. I want one of those. Because a lot of people didn't really know what business capabilities they are, how they hang together, and so forth. So in a lot of companies you see a lot of overlap, duplication of business, how they do things. One division does it that way, another one does it this way, and so forth. And so that's how we came to build a methodology. I never wanted to build a methodology, but I got to build one where we actually are working on effectively separating what we do with how we do it. And it turned out to be a very repeatable process for customers to see how it's going on. So there's a lot of know-how in strategy, in our enterprise strategy business, around business capability modeling, how to do this. And Microsoft, for example, IT, used the methodology to go back for specific problems. So they said, look, our order processing 12 years ago was a mess. We had 50 different order taking systems that were ordering. And all of the guys were effectively saying, no, my order process is special and different. And we used the capability modeling to really go deep into those ordering processes and find out where the differences are, and then come up with a single order process that still supports the variations, but isn't 50 different systems anymore. So we used it also for system cleanup and portfolio management. So when you think about business capabilities, these are the three big things you need to think about. First of all, we talk about capabilities. What is it that you're trying to do? And to go back to the example that Mark used, we have the Life Sports API and we have the Stats Sport API. It's a very simple way of looking at it. If you look at a bigger business application, you can see the HR system. And then beneath the HR system, you have payroll or benefits or other things. And then you go into benefits and you see a decomposition automatically happening. And a lot of times, capabilities have very nice ways for you to associate metrics, compliance thinking, ownership. Where do you source it? Sourcing in this case means who provides this capability for you? Is it not yet cloud, but is it maybe for the payroll you use a payroll provider instead of doing it yourself, like we do? I think we use ADT, right, as Microsoft? ADP, sorry. We use ADP as a payroll service for Microsoft, although we run our own HR system. We don't do payroll. So you can look at these kind of partitionings also as a business partitioning point. A lot of times we looked at these capabilities and then we looked at neighboring capabilities through the connectors. So what is the input? What's the output? What's the supporting function in terms of, am I supporting something to you? And then what's the compliance capabilities? This connector business, also we looked at how many times are we communicating? How often? In what time frame? If it's 2-3 interactions per day, per month, something like that, very easy to separate. If it's thousands of calls per second, you don't want to separate those guys because latency does matter, as we have learned. You might get around with different architecture tricks, but from a business perspective, you're kind of looking at it and saying, wait a second. The other thing, just to give you an example for this, how many people know why we have spring fashion shows that actually show winter clothing? And we have fall fashion shows that show spring and summer. How many people know that? Yeah. So it is all about the supply chain, it's logistics. Because most clothing is now being done in the Asia-Pacific region, even for the markets in Europe and so forth. These guys are trying to align the shipping lines, the transportation of raw material and all this other stuff together. So that's why we have this separation of business where the design happens in, let's say, Europe and the US, and then the production happens in Asia Pacific. And we looked at a couple of capabilities like taxing, and there are lots of import and export forms you have to do when you do international trading. And so one of the designs we did for a customer was, since the manufacturing happened in Asia Pacific, we actually moved the tax and import-export functions also over there, because they were much more inclined and closer to the manufacturing stuff than, for example, to the design stuff. And it had nothing to do with technology. It had all to do with what's the business process, the functions, the activities that are going on. So that's another very good way of looking at it and saying, if this is closer from a business perspective over there, cluster it over there. So what you're really doing here is a cluster analysis of related capabilities that are interacting with each other. You're trying to group or create a heat map to say, these five, they actually belong together. And you use the connectors as one thing, and you use the process as a, how do I connect capabilities? A lot of times we use the map metaphor here because the process is really the roads that you travel according to the map, because you can't, if there is no connector between capabilities, you can't travel that road because there's no data that you pass along, or you find out, oops, I missed a road, so I need to go back and think about, is there other input or output that I produce? One of the things I won't show here, is that there are multiple maps going on, because the telemetry map is another one where you say, okay, I want to capture a certain set of things. This is the business view, just pure business application or business functionality view. This is, for example, one of those where we looked at a concrete example of a business application modeling, merchandising, content management, orders, and so forth. And while this kind of looks like a technical drawing, it isn't. It is a business drawing that shows business connectivity and not yet clustering. A lot of these can be clustered in terms of, yep, we understand how that works in technology, but there are different considerations you go through when you look at technology to the point of data. So we did an analysis as part of the future planning for MBS. That was a long time ago, Microsoft Business Services, now Dynamics, where we looked at accounts receivable, accounts payable, and general ledger. So you would find them here somewhere. And the original idea was account receivable gets its own database, accounts payable gets its own database in terms of the database instance, and then GL as well. It turns out that from an operational perspective, the data is so cohesive, meaning 95% of the data is shared between these three business functions. And they also have a very, very tight update cycle, meaning while they don't run transactions against each other, AR and AP and GL are functionally, from a data perspective, very, very much aligned and very short intervals of delay that's acceptable. So we decided to keep AR, AP, GL together. Although business-wise, they actually are separatable, the data is so cohesive and integrated that we decided not to partition them that way. We gave them different APIs, but from a deployment and service perspective, AR, AP, GL became roles rather than services. Think about it that way. Why do you care about this business stuff? Most of you are hardcore technology people, but what you care about is completeness, for example. I've seen designs which were almost done and starting to code where I ask the simple question, so you are relying on orders. Okay, great, so you're an order management system. That's awesome. You are getting a catalog. Okay, good. Where is your vendor management function? How do you get a catalog? How do you sign up a vendor to provide a catalog to you? So you kind of follow the business train to understand, can you do what you try to do using that one? It also, as I said before, provides you very nice boundaries because the manufacturing and the design function are so far apart, they're very logically partitionable. And again, those kind of things. And you also get a lot of initial views on message exchange patterns. As I said, frequency, what kind of data is being, is it a just I'm informing you about stuff? A lot of systems inform the finance systems about stuff but don't expect any data back. So you can say, oh, it's a fire and forget kind of thing. Sometimes people say, hey, just tell me what's going on and I don't need to react. Sometimes people say, no. This is a dialogue between us two and I will change my behavior based upon what you tell me, those kind of things. All in business terms, not in technology terms. Again, think about abstraction. So a lot of times people get confused when they build software that they mix the what and the how together and not allow the two to separate. Let me give you a concrete example. One of the things we're looking at, we did a design for retail. How many of you use self-service? I'm sure all of you have used the self-service checkout, at least in the US, that's very popular. Because it's fast, you don't have to wait in line a lot. Again, it's getting sometimes actually now by faster to go to the human cashier because there's a bigger line, but fair enough. And so we kind of looked at it and saying, is this a capability or what's going on here? What are we, is this completely, entirely new? And then we decompose the checkout process. When you do this, when supported by the cashier, what's different to if you do it yourself? The difference was actually a requirement for the provider of the product to now give you the weight of the instance that you sold. Before, normally what people do is they have a pallet of stuff and that's weight. So that's what you get. But now they actually required in the catalog that they get from the supplier the weight of the individual good. And the only new capability that was available was that you had to weigh everything. Because what they used the weigh for and the previous, so you put the bag on the weight, on the scale, and then they use to scan it and weigh it and whatnot, and then you have another scale on the other side so that people don't cheat. So the weight of coming in and the weight of going out ought to be the same. In order to, for that to happen, they have to have the information that what the unit's weight is. That was really the only difference, is this weighing business in the scale, and for that they had to have the unit weight. So that was a very nice business analysis that led to technology changes and so forth. And it turns out that business capabilities are fairly stable. We do check out. That we do this with self-service checkout or with a cashier, it doesn't really matter that much. It's still the same thing. The how changed with some consequences, but not what we do. And a lot of times you see businesses being fairly stable. Again, I'm not sure the centuries is true, but that's clearly just to give you some thoughts. And they also have clear boundaries. Again, we talked about that before. And when you look at business process modeling or business modeling, a lot of people can do this in a day. They can go down to level 3 to give you as a technology person a first kind of view of how the business works, what they do. And then you can come back and do a technical analysis to say, okay, what are other considerations I have to go through, and so forth. The other piece I mentioned before is the completeness life cycle. So we talk a lot about the run cycle. When you talk about transactions or interactions and so forth, we talk a lot about when we exchange orders or when we buy things and shopping baskets and stuff like that. That's what we spend a ton of time on. That's why I said enough said. We do a lot of that. But what we don't do is, for example, establishing relationships. So when you think about an interface in this new world, why in EDI land do I have this much documentation? I've seen it, VW. For their EDI implementation, they have a mountain full of explanation what these various fields mean. So when you try to set up an EDI conversation with, let's say, a big company like VW, and there are no exceptions, they are just an example, you have to read, when they say 5.206, that means it's actually the manufacturing plant in Wolfsburg, it's the door 3, and oh, by the way, the SLA for that door is from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. you can deliver stuff. But only if you actually have sent a advanced shipping notification before. All of that stuff is written in English. And a lot of software is written in countries that are not native English speakers. You can see where that leads. So a lot of times I look at these kind of things as, is there a way for you to exchange these kind of relationship requirements in a programmatic interface? Don't go overboard, but for example, reference data I mentioned before. Lots of people make assumptions about reference data. They grab it, cache it, and then what? There is no strategy that I've seen yet where we officially as an industry say, here are the rules for reference data. Time to live, those kind of things. We'll talk a lot more about data later. But it is important when you take data from another service, let's say like customer data or the catalog or stuff like that, how long is that data valid? Tough one. And if that data is not valid anymore, but you use it in your service and send information to other people and the data is wrong, although it's semantically still okay, but it doesn't isn't valid anymore, tough luck. So there's a bunch of these kind of things that before you get here, you have to clarify. And then the analyzation, there are two pieces here. Run behavior is what I call it. The run behavior is when we do an interaction, a transaction, whatever the business transaction, what does that look like? And then relationship behavior. There's a lot of contractual behaviors between businesses where you say, it's perfectly okay to have damaged goods in a shipping relationship. But if you go over, let's say, 9% of damaged good over a year, then we will actually start to have negotiations about compensation. Each individual shipment cannot exceed 5% ship damaged good. Overall value of damaged good cannot exceed blah, blah. That's a very common thing you'd see in the supply chain. And since we are talking about software supply chains now, you will see those kind of things happening in relationships as well, where the SLA says, yes, I hear you, But in an overall interaction over a year, you cannot do this more than blah times and stuff like that. So think about these analysis pieces in the individual transaction, like Mark emphasized a couple of times in, when you talk about your SLA. But there is a lifecycle SLA across a period of time as well. We are not there yet in cloud computing. We are very simple service level models, but we will get there.
That actually sounds very similar to the quotas on the shared tier websites.
Yeah.
Because you have a per 5 minute, a per hour, I think it is, plus there's this little disclaimer of if you keep doing it, we're going to shut you down.
Yeah. And again, once you start trading goods and high value stuff, a lot of this becomes part of the way of looking at it. And then the other piece that we keep on saying, but I've yet to see people really doing it, we always say that the new world of software is designed for change. How many of you have really thought through how to change configuration on the fly and rebuild? The Microsoft software, just to be clear, the SQL Server team has done a great job of being able to support dynamic memory. So they will actually adjust their own memory allocation when you change the dynamic memory allocated to a VM. But they're pretty much the only software inside Microsoft that has done that. The rest of the software is still allocating statically, and you have to shut the software down before you can change it. So that's a configuration change. But our own things, I've seen software written for customers where it's assumed that the currency is US dollars. Well, who said that? Maybe the software actually will be exported now to people that use euros or Chinese currency or whatever. So simple things like that we just don't allow. Not only in the database sense of kind of loading the currency, but from the outside. Somebody wants to change your behavior to go switch from US dollars to euros. And there's lots of interesting consequences of that thing. So from my perspective, when I look at a life cycle, I always look at it as, how do I establish the connection between each other? How do I run what we agreed? How do I look at some of the behavior analytics? And then how do I look at the change process? And ideally, I go through this from a business lens first, so I get the technical underpinning right afterwards. Again, they are not 100% overlap, but there is quite a lot that the business guys can tell you very easily before you go into technical design. That's why you should always have a business analyst from yourself and a customer with you, because you will not know the right questions to ask. Because the HR guys have their own language, like we do, as do the doctors, as do the supply chain people, and so forth. I mentioned this one before, follow the trail. So you're trying to get an order management system up. The order management system requires catalogs. Catalogs requires vendors and so forth. So you can effectively use the logical modeling of the business to get to, oh, I need vendor management. And then you know that you have to have a new service or software or whatever and the process accordingly. Most of these examples are fairly simple, but I think you're getting the point of how you're looking at it. And it's also something where you look at it and saying, hey, purchase orders, that's a possible workload. Catalog management is a possible workload. And vendor management is a possible workload. That they are connected with each other is fine, but you can still look at these things. This is very highly available. This one might not be the vendor management. You only do that once in a while. You don't want to change vendors every day. Completeness, simple stuff. Again, from a business perspective, now a little bit techno-speak on that one. Can I create what I'm asking for? Can I create an order? For that, I need a catalog, blah, blah. Can I read it? Sometimes it's not okay to, it's okay to read. Can I update it? Sometimes it's not okay to update or delete things. As Mark mentioned on the personal side, and when he talked about the government scenario, most of you will know that you can't update a GL entry or delete one of those. General ledgers, you will go into jail, so you don't want to do that. That's what Enron and some of these other people, they modified their general ledger a little bit very creatively. So there's a bunch of stuff where the business tells you, nope, sorry, you can't update or delete this thing. You've got to create another entry that nullifies this other entry. And so that's where double booking and all these other things come from. So there's a lot of stuff that you can simply do saying, hey, is this okay? Do I need to do this? Can I do this? And so forth. Boundaries, mentioned some of them before. Geography. If the stuff is on the other side of the planet, you might want to put a service boundary around it. Because latency, as we have learned, does matter. If you have a manufacturing plant in, let's say, Taiwan, and your data center is in the US, you do know that's going to be painful. Very simple. Sourcing. Business people can tell you that this capability most likely is very volatile to sourcing, because we view it as a commodity, we view it as a non-business differentiator. They know that. They say, hey, we do this today, but I'm not sure why. If they start doing that, you know that you have to think about boundaries here and saying, okay, that might be a workload that needs to be isolatable. Because if they break it away, what do I do? If I make it an integrated part of my workload, the example I used at that time was Ford. Our friends from Ford had a CEO that was very innovative. He said, Ford is actually not in the manufacturing of cars. And I looked at, interesting. I thought they were a car manufacturer. That means manufacturing of cars. But he said, no. We are actually in the design of cars, and we are in the marketing of cars. That's what we really do. Okay. If your CEO says that, that has kind of consequences. Because then you have to think about, how do I isolate the manufacturing aspect of everything from the marketing and design aspect so that I don't integrate it too much? Because if he says we're not in that business, he might think about outsourcing of those capabilities. That's what this sourcing story is about.
Is that Jack Nasser?
I think it was Mr. Nasser.
Oh.
Yes.
Yep.
Again, the business guys have a bunch of information that we tend to ignore. Because they know, hey, this is our business purpose. We talked about technical drivers around boundaries. We talked about the data. So what's the percentage of data that is shared? It's okay sometimes to replicate. Sometimes it makes no sense to duplicate the data because they're so much the same. The interaction affinity, if it's this close and we are brethren and we are effectively doing everything together, don't separate those guys. Density. How much data is being pushed across pipes? If you have a video distribution service and that moves media back and forth between production system and the rendering system, for example, you want those guys close. You don't want to move terabytes of data all the time. And latency. If it's this thing requires you to be like this, quick, you can't put them on the other side of the planet. And then integrity needs, again, distributed transactions do not exist. Strike them off your vocabulary. They don't exist. Why? They just don't scale. Let me give you an example. One of the biggest failures I had in my career, and I was the most excited about it. So remember the good old MTS and Complus days where we had distributed transactions as a core principle? Pat Helland, who invented all that stuff, said that was his biggest mistake in his life. And I was a very enthusiastic person at that time, quite a long years ago. And I worked with SAP at the time as the Microsoft architect for all the R&D activities, SQL Server, NT, and whatnot, with our friends from SAP, big ERP company. And we came up with the notion of a DCOM connector so that a VB programmer could actually integrate SAP functionality into their applications. In 1997, that was a very novel concept. Nobody had done that kind of thing. And so we built this, and then the next phase we said, and people loved that one. That was cool. And then next phase we built a resource manager that's part of the DTC architecture, the distributed transaction coordinator. There is a resource manager. SAP in this case was the resource manager. And we showed that in a two-phase commit transaction between a VB program and an SAP system at a very big SAP conference. I'm sure if we had shown it at the Microsoft conference, everybody would have cheered. Yay, VB, transactions, Microsoft, cool. At the SAP conference, you could see tears in people's eyes. You're saying, excuse me, you're going to hold my SAP hostage by a VB program? Until that VB program, maybe that pops up a dialogue that says, user, would you please confirm? The user happens to be having coffee somewhere so that this clicking thing didn't work. And so these guys were truly, they were after the session, they came to us and said, you're not going to release this, right? This is not going to be enabled. Don't do this. And SAP never shipped it. It was perfectly working, perfectly according to protocol. They never shipped it because distributed transactions mean the other side is held hostage by the other side. Whoever initiates the transaction effectively says, and I will control you. And services cannot be controlled. There is a good old SOA rule that says services are autonomous. And there is a reason for that. Now, since I know that you guys listen, but not really, I also said, I want to clarify, transactions are a good thing. Transactions against a single data source are awesome. Just don't distribute them between data sources. And I'm being careful here. I'm not saying databases. I'm saying data sources. SAP is not a database. It's a complex business application system that we turned into a resource manager for our Visual Basic friends. And no offense to the Visual Basic community, but there were certain behaviors, as we discussed before, that you wouldn't see in high availability, high resilient computing.
I'd add to understanding interactions the fact that in these kind of systems, you nearly always have to deal with transient errors.
Yeah.
So when you're talking to SQL Azure, in fact, there's application talk, which handles it, but that's a very common scenario.
Yeah. So the observation is that one of the interaction modes you need to think about is transient errors, and Mark will talk about transient errors and how to deal with those guys, because it is a very common scenario. Functional services, operational services, I walked you through the ARAPGL scenario, that the functionality-wise, they are actually quite separate, and there are different APIs for those guys, but on the operational side, hosting of the database, compliance, the unit of replacement, meaning if you outsource this functionality, would you just outsource AR, AP, or GL, or would you take the whole thing? As it turns out, business functionality-wise, those three get outsourced together. You do not outsource them separately. Go back to the HR example. Payroll gets outsourced a lot. HR doesn't. Benefits management gets outsourced a lot, but HR per se doesn't. So there's a couple of these kind of business drivers that are clearly showing you what is a good boundary around workloads versus what's a not so good boundary. They're not really bad boundaries, except if you found out that the communication between the systems is so tight and so dense that the latency is getting in the way of the functionality of the app. And again, there are also ways around that, and we will talk about some of those. Componentization. So this is now business stuff. Now you have a business capability map and you understand what's going on. Now let's talk a little bit about technology. What are the techniques that we are looking at when you componentize the system? And why do you want to do that? And again, workload modeling is all about composition and decomposition. Finding the right boundaries between stuff so you can put it one on the left side and another one on the right side and it continues to work. The Windows guys did some awesome work when they designed Windows Server 2008. It was all based upon a big, big effort that Brian Valentine, when he was at Microsoft and running the Windows team, kicked off. Because the Windows team had done a lot of functional work, but they didn't do a lot of code hygiene in the 90s. And so in 2000, with Windows 2000, it was really hard to ship Windows 2000. It took us 5 years. 2 years longer than we anticipated. Remember NT5 being the system that was supposed to be shipping in 1998-ish? We shipped it in late 2000 and Brian had to take over. So he said afterwards, we've got to fix this. We've got to do something. And what they did is they did a lot of code analysis that led to Vista being the first componentized OS. We broke it apart and put it into the components and had defined interactions, layers, and stuff like that. And Vista, despite its infamousness for lots of other reasons, was actually the first commercial operating system that has componentization built into its core. Setup, everything is componentized. It's quite actually, in engineering-wise, from a monolithic or from a source code module architecture to components, that was quite a feat. And a lot of the work that came from Windows 7 and Windows Server 2008 built on all that componentization. So what did they do and why? So they built reusable components to effectively clean up their code, make it manageable, self-describing, and so forth. Then they said, components are effectively low-level building blocks. You don't get to see them in Windows. We actually are going to put features together. And then the next one is roles. Let me stop you here and walk you through some examples. If you have played around with Windows Server 2003, SP1, you will see that we have added a role wizard to the thing. Remember those times, if you were here? We did a role wizard, but it was kind of like lipstick on a pig, meaning there was really no role thinking underneath. All the software pieces were deployed. We were already secure by design, so they weren't active per se, but you effectively had all the software on the system, and it was one big deployment blob. And you turned those things on using the role wizard. Using the componentization model and a new concept called Windows Server Core, which most of you will have heard about at least, if not, read it up, which effectively allows you to take off desktopness, let's call it that, off the Windows Server, and then install just what you need. That's when they really use these techniques to say, hey, I have a print server role, or a file server role, or a directory server role, or an app server role, that's now common. And in the file server, for example, I can take features like NFS or SIFS, which are the two file protocols we support, and turn them equally on or off. And so really, in Windows Server 2008, they use this technology set to help you configure the software the way you need it, and they only deployed, really deployed this time, only what they needed. And they used this mechanism to do that. And then they used workloads, and their workload is effectively a bunch of server roles you put on a single server, and then so forth. How can we use this? If you think about workloads now, you can think about a solution which is a set of workloads or services, and we can now look at the workload, saying, hey, this is payroll, this is HR, this is benefits, this is this or that or the other. And benefits is made up of a number of roles that might or might not be relevant. If I have a role that does, EDI for payroll, because we are also wanting to enable EDI, but I have other ways of doing that, I might not turn that on. I say, nope, this role does not get deployed. I have it in my functional spec, so if a customer wants that configuration, I can do it. A SharePoint example would be, I can use search and I cannot use search. So search would be a role, or maybe a workload, but let's say a role for now, and I can turn it on or off. I cannot deploy it or deploy it. And so it's effectively not only a lifecycle tool, it's also a security tool, attack surface reduction, that kind of thing. And then inside search, I might say, I have video search enabled, I have text search enabled, I have voice search available as features. I won't turn voice and video on because I only do search text. So again, I'm trying to give you analogies that are very exemplary. And then you have components that are effectively the software that build all this stuff. And some of them is actually deployed more than once because we use process isolation to have the functionality available. So the source code is managed once, but the deployment might be multiple times. And again, Microsoft pioneered a lot of this work in the early 90s with Olay and COM and all this other stuff. We did a lot of this component work, and I would love to see more designs that talk about, here are my components of reuse of code, and here's my feature set that I'm trying to deploy, and here's the role, and the workload is actually composed out of multiple roles. This is for complicated software. This is not for your simple website, but if you have a complex website with commerce and with social integration and all these other things which are normal these days, you want to start thinking about composition like this, so you can isolate it from a both software management approach, so think application lifecycle management, but also with respect going back to availability, SLAs, and all these other things. Because some things might not be necessary to be deployed or available at a given scale or time. I'm sure most of you have seen this picture to the right. This is the PNP picture of how you're supposed to decompose your applications. And a lot of this is still, 100% valid. There are some nuances that have crept in, but there is certainly a lot of goodness in that style. If you haven't seen it, so the way we look at this is the first thing you do is decompose by function, in this case of component, feature, role, workload, that kind of thing. And then you're trying to find commonality around type, meaning if it's a UX component or if it's a service layer, that kind of thing. Because then you can say, well, I have a component that does HTML rendering, let's say, or a feature. You want to put that here and say, hey, all of my other guys should use the same HTML rendering. So you kind of have another swipe through the system to say, now I'm taking these things, group them by type. First I do by function, then I do by type. Because we are not Windows Server, so we don't think about servers anymore, we think services. And what I'm trying to do here is help you decompose the word service. Because a service can be very big, and you don't really want to end up with 40 million lines of code in a single service that is one monolithic block. And that's why we're talking about these techniques, just to give you that idea. This is real-life product group guidance from real experiences when they looked at their source code. So there are three groups that I know of, four actually, that I know of that have went through a similar exercise. The Windows guys did the brute force one. They went through the entire code and they componentized the entire thing in one big bang. Windows Vista was the result. I will not comment on that one. You can draw your own conclusions. The Exchange team did something similar to the Windows team, but they didn't touch their store. So the store.exe, the core database functionality, is still C++ code, fairly rich store services, but they took everything else and rewrote it in .NET and are introduced first, I think, three or four roles into their workload, and then I think they're now at 15 different roles that you can use for deployment and functionality design. But when you look at it, components provide well-defined sets of functionalities. Should be obvious, but it's good to think about. They're looking at the code base, not some artificial over-document thing. So Mike, as our ALM champion, it's code that's true, not documentation that's true. And then really drive component definition through your testing and so forth. So the SQL Server team, where I took this from, actually have now changed for the component part of their code base, because they are going piece by piece. They have switched to component-oriented unit testing rather than functional unit testing and stuff like that. They're also introducing component owners into the system, so there's PMs and devs that are owning components, and they own the contract between the components and the rest of the code base and stuff like that. Refactor your code. There's a bunch of interesting tools. These are the Visual Studio 2010 versions. We haven't updated the slide, but the 2012 versions still have those tools. And as a Visual Studio MSDN subscribers, you can also get the C++ versions, not just the managed code version. But we ship the managed code versions. The C++ version is only available in MSDN. The SQL Server team actually did use this tool set to analyze their code base and see what makes sense to put into components. So this is about existing code base analysis. And the Office guys did a whole bunch of work when they moved to WinRT, so the Windows runtime, the new application environment on Windows. They did a whole bunch of this kind of work because nobody thought that Win32 might not be the API we write our applications to. So Win32 has about 48,700 something unique API calls. That's a lot of functionality. And Office uses 8,000 something of those APIs. And so they went through a bunch of recoding and refactoring when they moved over to WinRT and whatever other targets they might have over time. Decomposition and the business angle of it is about the why question. Why are we doing this? Does it make sense? And so, and then draw the technical stuff. Again, we are tending, the compiler is already hot when we arrive because we love writing code. That's what we do, right? And part of my begging, at least to the services people, is start thinking before you start coding. My view is think a lot before you start coding, but that's just me. Okay, Mark. Throttling. Okay.
Throttling. So we talked about throttling before, where you could get throttled or have your service get throttled by a service you were consuming. But now you've decomposed your application by workloads. You've done all the good things that Louise just told you to look at. And now you're looking at, all right, I'm going to go ahead and make this available to a set of consumers. They may be people that you know, people inside the enterprise. They may be known partners, so people that you've got a business relationship with, part of your supply chain. It may also be people that you want to become familiar with, building out an ecosystem. So I love the fact that Nike now, is the shoe company, is now a software company. They have their own APIs for Nike Plus and those sorts of things. So now they need to think about, all right, so I want to build an ecosystem. How do I do that in a way that's going to make sure that everyone has a great experience and I can do that in a way that makes sense? And then blacklisting bad actors. So these are people that are just trying to wreak havoc on your system. You get all sorts of, whether they're hackers, hacktivists, someone who just doesn't like you. How do you deal with those? And then there's unintentional bad actors. So unintentional bad actors, example with LinkedIn. So there's this website that someone had put together. It's actually quite cool and very addictive in a very weird way, where in LinkedIn it's a social network for business people. And what they would do is they would show you two people that you worked with. And you'd say, who do you like working with better, Johnny or Susie? And they're, all right, who do you like better, David or Sally? And you're going through this thing, and now you're effectively ranking these people, and then they find out about it, and it starts going viral, and people are starting going through the system, and it catches on the web and goes really quickly. But they built against the public API. So these guys are not a bad actor, right? They're doing exactly what LinkedIn asked them to do. They said, all right, we'd like you to go and grow an ecosystem, build interesting apps around it, which is going to get more people into our system. Because if they want to play, they have to be in the LinkedIn system. They're going to grow their user base, that sort of thing. So you have a decision to make at that point. For an unintentional bad actor, how do you want to deal with them? So there are a couple different techniques you can take. So there's also whitelisting partners. So if we're going to launch Windows 7 and we want to have deals we're going to have some data streams we're going to be putting out there with partners of ours that we've got great relationships with, they may get an API key or they may be using OAuth, so they're going to get some certain claims associated with their account or with their service. They're going to give them access to beyond what is publicly stated. And then we're going to have the unintentional bad actor. So we talked about constraints that we're going to be on services for SLAs. Well, usually there's some leeway. If you make more than 5,000 requests, we don't say that we'll turn you off or whatever the current rates are for different services you're using. But you will likely get throttled at some point. And based on an algorithm, they will go ahead and throttle you down. So what you may be able to do for unintentional bad actors is do what they call pulse throttling. So you're making because one of the concerns you have is you want to keep your API healthy. So you don't know necessarily if that's a bad actor or an unintentional bad actor. So whether you're writing client software, you're writing the service, what you can do is you can do pulse throttling. So you've made way too many requests in a certain period of time or a particular type or whatnot. And I can now start denying your request because notionally there's some sort of identity, some sort of claims that you're providing that lets me identify you for a known period of time. And it's a sliding window. And I keep throttling you until you stop. So if you continue if you send me 1,000 requests or 20,000 requests, I start to throttle you. And then if you continue to do that, that throttle window keeps going. And I'll have that, once you stop, I'll have it open for 5 minutes. And notionally, I'm sending you these error messages, so you should be able to figure out, wow, it's going to flip what we call a circuit breaker. We'll talk about that after lunch. That says, yeah, these are the issues that are happening. I might want to take some course corrective actions. Maybe I want to go to a cache. Maybe I want to slow things down. Maybe I want to see if I'm in a supply chain of services, there may be people calling my service that are bad actors, and you can sort of have that cascading effect. And then for known bad actors, think about, you know, how are you authenticating users and what are the different ways that you might be able to identify them and shut them down. So I talked about a site that I worked with some folks on earlier for the public sector. And there was a very well-known hacker group that came after it. And they were, whatever their purposes are, I can give them credit for being very smart, very agile, and giving me some of the best challenges of a 48-hour period I've had in my career. And really understanding, you know, how do they work, and is it, guess what? What they're doing is they are signing up for accounts inside of the system. A lot of them are coming from the same email domain. So that's a way that I can throttle based on number of requests per domain. I can either throttle that domain, or I could slow down how fast I'm actually turning people on. So that'll give me some more time to respond. I could also say, you know what, they're all coming from North Korea or some other country. Well, from IP ranges that are coming from North Korea, I can now start saying, you know what, we'll get back to you. And you just don't let them get onto the system. Or you may be legitimate users from North Korea, who knows. You can say, I'll I've received your registration, you'll get an email from me. Maybe that'll come out in 3 hours or a day or something like that, and you can throttle them down. But really, come to terms with this up front, because you don't want to be doing this on the fly. Because when you do have bad actors, they tend to come fast and hard, and they're probably some of the smartest folks you'll have to go against. And you want to make sure you get that in place, so it's very easy to just sort of have all the knobs and switches that you need. And again, the nice thing about decomposing by workload is I can now take a view on this at a workload-specific in a workload-specific way. So there may be things that are higher priorities in terms of security that I want to lock down. There may be other things that I really don't care about, and I'm going to be able to allocate the right level of security and the right level of throttling based on what makes sense for me there. So up to this point, we've done lifecycle modeling. We've looked at the life cycle of the app. We've figured out what our workloads are. We've determined what our availability is. So we want this available this much. The next thing you need to look at is what's the capacity model and plan. So after lunch, we're going to talk about these things called scale units. But what you really want to be able to do now is sort of model out, based on the availability I want to deliver for the given life cycle, here's how I'm going to make a certain set of resources available. This is the capacity that I'm going to put forward to deliver on that availability. So what's the number of servers, what's the number of resources I'm going to have, and what's the way I'm going to do that? Because my workloads, if I've got an SLA, they're guaranteed under that agreement. What's the capacity I'm going to use to go ahead and deliver that? So a big part of this is you need to understand what's going to go wrong. Because I have this SLA, I want to deliver this capacity, I want to deliver this availability, I'm going to have a certain level of capacity, and that's informed by what can go wrong. So, and how I'm addressing that. So if you look at failure points, which we've got up on the board right now, these are places inside of your solution, inside of your workload service, that can go wrong. These are higher level areas. So if you look what's up here, we talk about configuration files, we talk about website connections, database connections, registry keys. These are things that are points inside of my applications where things can go wrong. And we have lots of interesting examples of those sorts of things. And then within those points, you have different modes. So a configuration file is not in the right location. Or I've moved the wrong configuration file to production. We had a customer that did a very large-scale site, and they were using a test database in production for 45 minutes because someone didn't use an automated script. They just decided to move things, and they had the test script running or the test configuration running in production. Or you may have too much traffic overusing resources. So if someone floods me with 50,000 requests in a minute, how am I going to respond to that? That's a failure mode, and then I need to figure out how I want to address that. Database reaches maximum capacity. One of the big things that we see with the solutions is people invest a lot of time in building these really cool and really slick, highly scalable web front ends, and they use a single database in the back end, right? That database gets scaled, there's contention issues, all sorts of things there. And then if you look at different types of services, if you look at, say, SQL Azure Database, for example, there's a finite size to a database. And there are reasons for that, but you need to plan that in. And if you don't get throttled, that's fine, but at a certain point, you've hit the maximum capacity. So it scales until it doesn't, and at that point, you need to make some decisions. I've worked with a customer that said, you know what, we're not going to worry about that. And then they became wildly popular. And then what could have been a three-day decision on or discussion point, that's a failure mode that we're going to address through a partitioning strategy. And maybe it takes 3 to 5 days for them to figure out. It's now a 3-month live migration that causes them lots of pain and is having opportunity impacts because they can't add other features to their site that they'd like to. And oh, by the way, they now it's a social site. And if you have popular people on the social site, they're sending millions of users in at any given time when they do a post. So it's almost like you're trying to get things done. Of course, a lot of the stuff you're doing in production, and someone's yelling, incoming! And there's like 3 million, 5 million, 10 million people that come in, and you have to sort of back off and get things going in the right way. And it's just a bit of a nightmare. For trustworthy computing inside of Microsoft, they've been doing a lot of work in this area. And we show you the tooling at the end of the day we've put together to help you with some of these techniques we've talked about. They've got a really good set of tooling that look at failure modes and failure points, and then understanding what it is you want to do to respond to those. And you may decide to do nothing, right? If you look at this in a real-world example, think of it like insurance. I'm not sure if you guys know, in Seattle, maybe they didn't tell you this at the travel agency, we're prone to earthquakes. Right? We haven't had one in a while, but it'd be a really nasty situation if we had one. And if you have real estate here, you might want to think about insurance, right? And once you know that there's earthquakes here, it's knowing what you don't know, and you say, you know what, I do or don't want it. But at least you're making an informed decision. A lot of times customers are not necessarily making an informed decision because they haven't worked this out. We had a project in Spain where they were building a ferry system, and they were migrating from mainframe code. It was written in COBOL and migrating over to .NET and putting it up in our cloud. And as the gentleman pointed out earlier, you need to think about resiliency and these transient faults that happen, right? So as we said earlier, nothing is 100% uptime as far as the services we've talked about today. And I can make a request 99 times, and then the 100th time it doesn't connect. And what we do is you build in resilient fault handling inside your code. We'll talk about that after lunch. But they said, you know what, we're moving this COBOL code over. This is really a low usage scenario, right? So if I click the big red button to buy a ticket, and it comes back with an error and says it doesn't work, well then Susie or Dave or whoever's working the ticket desk that day can just press it again. Like the cost for me of re-architecting my application, putting in more error handling, putting all this stuff in, really, for me, it's a lot of money. For me, I'll take the risk. And there are other things where people decide to take risks. If you look at what happened with Netflix and the outage we talked about earlier, they made a conscious decision to do something that they probably have rethought since. But it's okay for you to not fault to address every single failure mode. But it's taking an informed decision and making sure you understand that these are the things that can go wrong. So this is some common code that's in variations of this are in most applications. So if we look at this, we're going to a database, we're going to run a stored procedure, we're going to go collect some data back, and we're going to go ahead and have some error handling, and we're going to write out to a log file. Well, failure points here, there's a database server, there's a database, there's a table, there's a configuration file that's there, and you can see the database is not responding, could be offline, may not exist, the table may not exist, the stored procedure might not exist. The stored procedure may exist, but you don't have rights to access it. So there are a number of different things that are here. And what you can start seeing is there are a number of things you can just test to make sure that they're there as part of your application and you can address inside of your solution. The other thing is that these are very granular. There are also higher level things like, hey, my data could get corrupted. If I need to do, how do I handle backups? If a backup fails, how do I handle that? And those sorts of things. But this goes down to a granular level. But really understanding your application. And it's funny, you should really look at this for your entire application. I worked with someone recently, and it's two different product groups in a company. And they said, yeah, my code's great, I just don't trust the other guy. So they're looking at the service interface level, what are the things that I can count on, and really looking at the failure modes from the interface interactions that they're going to have across the two services.
Additional videos in this series can be found on Channel 9 at http://channel9.msdn.com/whack-series/whack-failsafe. In addition, Microsoft Services and the Azure Customer Advisory Team have produced white papers and guidance on these subjects. You can find these on the Azure Architecture Center at http://www.windowsazure.com/en-us/develop/net/architecture.